Call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. And two items, two bills on the agenda today. First up is House File 3607. Author is Representative Bradley from Rochester, and by coincidence, this deals with Rochester. I'll make the motion that House File 3607 be a laid over for possible inclusion or omnibus bill at the conclusion.
Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind, I believe you have an amendment to your packet, AO61245, that was given to us by Finance just as a way of making it more clear on the intention of funding.
Oh, okay. Members have that any questions? Okay. Then I'll move amendment 1245. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Representative Bradley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I sit in the chair a little extra excited because I really am. I mean, $5 million in the big scheme of things is not a lot of money, but it is a really important investment that's before the committee today and will be laid over. There'll be a lot of clarification, and we've got wonderful presenters that can lay out the whole thing, but I do want to add a little bit of a personal touch. I stand before you because I care what happens to our state, what happens to the southeast part of Minnesota, and certainly what happens in my own community. Just to give you a feeling, there's 39,000 people every day that commute into Rochester as sort of the economic engine for the region. What's good there is good for our entire region. And we've been trying to make sure that we can continue for Rochester and for the state. And the legislature has been a part of that, the genomics investments that are being made, the partnership with the University of Minnesota in that work has been absolutely sensational. Even I think beyond expectations that I've had, we've also some bioscience work that's gone on. But in sort of the whole picture of how do you continue to fuel the engine, it really is important also to have the kind of signature programs, the higher education graduate, doctorate kinds of level programs that are represented in this expansion of the University of Minnesota. This is about, and they're about programs that, to be perfectly honest with the committee, I'm not even sure I can pronounce names of some of the programs, but they are very specialized programs. Think about this. Students from wherever in the United States, or for that matter even international, opportunities to come into an area where you are able to, as you're doing your graduate work, your doctorate work, whatever it may be, and you're thinking even about interns, to have the icons of Mayo Clinic, of IBM as being potential partners in that education. We really believe that this will be an attraction for education. Now, it's still not big numbers because these are highly specialized, and of course it's also a feeder. I mean, these are the kind of people that you want to draw into the state and you'd like them to be able to stay there. I want to emphasize something. I believe that this is absolutely win-win. I served several years on the foundation at Winona State University. I have a great love. One of the exchange students that lived with us attended Winona State University. I helped her through a lot of that attendance. And I believe the wonderful partnership that we've had with Winona State University, with other higher education that have got all kinds of presence in Rochester, will continue to flourish. And this is not about diminishing any of that. This is about all ships rising. I absolutely believe that. And that's why I stand before the committee today so enthusiastically. The bill doesn't do too much more than what I said, other than since now we are talking about legitimizing. Now, we're not talking about a football plane, band plane, that kind of institution. We are talking about a very highly specialized expansion of University of Minnesota programs that you'll get more detail on. So what it does in the language is just to clarify the language so that it fits, and then in addition it has the appropriation language. And Mr. Chair, it would be my suggestion to give the opportunity for the presentations, and then certainly after that's completed, we would stand for questions.
Thank you. So unless there are questions of Representative Bradley, we'll proceed then with the presentation.
Okay.
Please identify yourself for the record, whoever is going to make the...
Chair Norris, I'm Marilyn Stewart. I'm chair of the Rochester Higher Education Development Committee. And I have with me at the table Drew Flotta and Mike Beckett, who are also members of our committee, and they will be reporting along with me this morning. Also, we have with us Dr. Robert Jones, who is Senior Vice President of the University of Minnesota. We have Dr. Linda Baer, who is Senior Vice Chancellor of the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. We have Jim Clausen, who is a community leader and in our area and is a past chair of the Grout Board. Jane Rankin, who is another member of our committee, is an executive budget officer with the Minnesota Department of Finance. Dr. David Carl, who is provost of the University of Minnesota in Rochester. And I probably missed somebody because I can't see the back of my head. In any case, the Rochester Higher Education Development Committee, as you know, was established by the 2005 legislature. And we were given the charge to recommend a form of higher education that would best meet the unique opportunities that are presented in Southeast Minnesota. For the last 7 months, we have researched, we've consulted national experts, we've received reports from a wide variety of area employers, we have received reports from other higher ed providers and from research partners. We've commissioned studies, we've analyzed, we've negotiated among ourselves, and we have developed a bold plan for a new look in 21st century higher education. Several times each month, we met for 3 hours on a Friday morning starting at 7 a.m. so that our members who had to drive down from the metro area learned what it was to meet in Rochester at 7 a.m. In between those full committee meetings, we had small work groups that met, and they focused on program, governance, funding, and facilities. The Rochester Higher Education Development Committee is an amazing, incredible group of leaders who became a team as they worked together. They are capable and creative, committed, dedicated, and I can tell you, absolutely determined. Together, we've developed a plan which is not about Rochester, it's about Minnesota. It's about investment in Minnesota's economic development in a global economy. It's about jobs, and it's about increased revenue for this state. It is about new cutting-edge programs that are not available elsewhere. It's not about duplication, it's about collaboration. It's about partnerships, public and private, and it's about enhancing current partnerships and growing together. It is not about a typical branch campus. There is no intent to look like UMD. As Fran said, no bands, no football teams. It is also not about a new four-year university. It is about building on the University of Minnesota Rochester, which we already have, but with very specialized programs and a very specialized focus. The University of Minnesota already delivers 4 PhDs, 16 masters, and 8 baccalaureate degrees, about 35 total programs, and when we include some of the certificate programs. We partner with other university branches. We currently partner with the University of Minnesota Duluth for an MBA program that is held in Rochester, and we have more students in the MBA program in Rochester than they have at the Duluth campus. That shows you one example of the real need. The time is now. After 7 months of study, consultation, and planning, we believe that the University of Minnesota is uniquely and exclusively qualified to capitalize on the opportunities in Rochester to advance Minnesota. You know what I forgot to do is show you who these wonderful people are. I can't talk and push the buttons at the same time. This is this great committee that has worked nonstop for 7 months. Economic growth in the 21st century is highly dependent on the establishment of a bioeconomy which can take technological innovation into the marketplace. Rapidly exploding bioscience industries are focused on genomics, bioinformatics, healthcare, and those will fuel our national economy. The strongest opportunity for our state lies in Rochester because of its unique industry base in medical and biological technology, engineering, and information technology, and because of work which is already underway in public and private partnerships. Rochester is Minnesota's third largest city. In the last 10 years, Rochester has grown as a research and development hotbed, attracting more than 30 companies who are working on the cutting edge of technological, medical, and biological advances. Rapidly growing Mayo Medical Laboratories processes 20,000 tissue samples daily. They are flown in from all over the world. There are 500 new jobs at Mayo Medical Laboratories in the last 2 years. World-renowned Mayo Clinic is Minnesota's largest private employer, with 47,000 workers who live all over southern Minnesota and northern Iowa and are bused in to work in Rochester. Mayo is a major player in American bioscience research, investing approximately $372 million in research funds in 2004. And $5 million in tuition reimbursement for employee education. IBM is the state's largest high-tech employer with 4,400 employees in Rochester. IBM Rochester is the home of the Center of Advanced Studies in Life Sciences and Bioinformatics. The director of that department at IBM is sitting in my immediate left, Drew Flotta. And it is also the development lab and production center for BlueGene, the world's fastest supercomputer. IBM invests $500 million annually in research and development and $2 million in employee education in Rochester. There are several other research and academic partnerships already existing and working in Rochester. The Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics, which Fran had mentioned, the University of Minnesota Hormel Institute, which is partnering with Mayo Clinic and cancer research, and we have several current bachelor's degree level programs where the academic work is done at the University of Minnesota Rochester and the clinical work at the Mayo Clinic. When you look at successful technology economy development across the United States, it quickly becomes very clear that research institutions have been at the heart of the boom that has occurred in each of those areas. The Silicon Valley in California, the Research Triangle in North Carolina, there's Austin, Texas, Boston, San Diego, you name it. All of those areas are areas where growth of new businesses and offshoot industries were fostered by publicly sponsored research and partnerships between local industries and local university. The development of a skilled workforce will drive new companies to success, and it should be noted that while some of the new advanced skills that will be required in the workforce will need to come from the University of Minnesota Rochester research side, a variety of new skills across the spectrum will be required. And this is where there are unique opportunities for MinSCU and other private education providers that are established in Southeast Minnesota. Each one of those institutions will have a mission. Investment by the state of Minnesota can fill the gap in Southeast Minnesota's economic engine by accelerating the growth of the University of Minnesota in Rochester and advancing Minnesota. If the UMR component is strengthened and expanded, the economic potential of these partnerships and research engines for the state of Minnesota will be absolutely phenomenal. Studies indicate that resources like those in Rochester must be fueled by a major higher education research institution. The result will be product innovation, new business development, more jobs created, and increased revenue for our state. While Minnesota is rich in potential, it is seriously lagging behind more aggressive states. Florida invested $310 million in economic development dollars and nearly $200 million in higher education funds to attract a Scripps Institute branch from California to Florida. In Arizona, Mayo and Arizona State University and TGen in Scottsdale already have the university research component. They also have a new $50 million research grant for funding research scientists just in Maricopa County. Phoenix also just voted to approve a $232 million expansion of Arizona State University in downtown Phoenix. We are keenly aware that both Mayo and IBM, who are our major partners and who are very significant partners in the state of Minnesota, also have major locations in Arizona and Florida, where huge amounts of public and private funds are already being invested in bioscience research partnerships. Our recommendation to the governor and to our Minnesota legislature is for a mere $5 million in 2006. With a very clear understanding of Minnesota's resources, all of which are in place to fuel the economy, except for specialized higher education, the Rochester Higher Education Development Committee recommends this vision. The intent is not to duplicate existing higher education programs, but to create something highly unique and specialized. This new investment in Minnesota will be for a Rochester campus of the University of Minnesota. It is to be an extension of the Twin Cities main campus with unique programs, unique research, and unique degree offerings based in Rochester. The degrees through this campus will be conferred by the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. This is a history of the many ways in which we have tried to bring more and better higher education opportunities to Southeast Minnesota for the past 20 plus years. Some of us would say, as you may all know, our former Senator Braddis, she said it's been 40 years. We've tried to make do with whatever we could put together, but however, the time has now come for the next level in academic partnerships. And I'm going to ask Drew to share with you the information on the signature academic partnerships, because he served on that work group. And do we need to move it over there? So there we go.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Drew Flotta. I am on the Higher Education Development Committee, as Marilyn says, working on the programming group. In my day job, I am the director of the Mayo Clinic Collaboration and Life Sciences Development for the IBM Corporation based in Rochester. As we looked at the development of the programs that surround what we've developed here, we really focused in on the economic side of this. How can we turn what exists in Rochester from an industry confluence standpoint? And that's this whole perspective that medical science and biosciences are coming together very tightly now with the engineering and information technology arenas. We looked at research being the core to what needs to drive this economic engine further. So as you see the programs we've developed and we've focused on, research is the core and is really the driver of what it's all about. And it's research in partnership, not only with what happens at a public institution, but very much tied to the industry partnerships that exist within the Rochester community today. So we see a very strong role that the Mayo Clinic, that IBM, and that Hormel Institute and others in the region can play in this. And as we work through the industry partnerships and looked at where this could go, there certainly is a commitment from all of these parties to play very strongly in this arena. If you look at what research leads to, research is you bring in the right types of people, if you bring in as what we term as the rock stars to drive this sort of research, it also brings in the program development that you need to develop the next level of skills that are going to drive the businesses that are created. So really the PhD and master's level programs based off of the research that we are talking about is very core and critical to what the development is about. These are the people who create the technologies, these are the people who do the real research, and by the way, these are the people who spawn the companies to come out of this type of work as well. Associated very tightly to this, there will be specific baccalaureate programs that we envision will come out of this type of work. And we see that really happening in two areas. We would see baccalaureate program offerings that would come out of the University of Minnesota directly related to the unique skills and the unique technologies that will be developed. We also see a definite need for baccalaureate and also certificate level programs for workforce development that we believe the Minsky system will play a very strong role in developing as these technologies come to creation. We see this as being a cycle that leads to other things, and one of the things it leads to is a reputation that draws in others. And what does it draw in? It draws in the creation to keep flowing things back into research. It keeps other people engaged, it keeps the money flowing, and it keeps money coming in from a variety of areas. Part of that is having the opportunity and the capability to deliver these technologies into the marketplace, and that's where we see the University of Minnesota as playing an extremely strong role. You need the capability to license and transfer the technologies that are developed. You need the ability to do things like bring in new companies and investments, and the University of Minnesota's Technology Transfer Office is an ideal opportunity to do just that. Now, as this reputation is established and develops, it also leads to other things, and it leads to more money, quite frankly, from other areas. It leads to investment from outside of the area, from the federal government, in this case, the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health, but we also see the opportunity for multiple private investors to come in and augment this even further. So we see this as one of these virtuous cycles that can be created through the investment, with really the public research institution being at the core of success. When you look specifically at the program offerings that we developed as we went through, we looked at this whole area of, as I said earlier, the confluence that's occurring between information and engineering technology and medicine and the biosciences. And as I speak of this confluence, it really is that information has become more critical to how medicine is delivered. The ability to provide tools and capabilities to do the research, to do the practice improvements, to really do the changes that are required really are there. So as we define the program offerings that are here, you see a series of overlapping circles to try to represent this. And that really says that each one of these programs really needs to be taught in a cross-disciplinary sort of way. I'll give you an example that's at the top of the list for both the engineering technology fields as well as the health science, and that's this area of biomedical informatics. And to put it succinctly, biomedical informatics is all about using the information that exists within medicine much more effectively to drive new research, new discovery, and practice renovation. If you look at how you teach this, you can teach computer sciences the basis to deliver these type of programs, but they have to have cross-training in medicine in order to speak the language and understand the specific research that you need to do. The same is true if people are trained medically. They can have the understanding of what the information, how the information needs to be used, but not necessarily how to manage and manipulate it effectively. So these sorts of programs really are cross-disciplinary in the way they need to be taught and delivered. And as we see the third portion of this, and that's the business skills, we think it's critical that as we teach these type of programs, as we do the research around them, that we embed core business capabilities within that type of teaching programs. And those are in the areas of entrepreneurship, innovation, and leadership. And again, our expectation is as we create these programs, as we create these technologies and the skills that can drive them, we will also be creating the management skills that go up and deliver these into the business world and create the economic engine that we are trying to achieve. As we look from a program standpoint, we also looked at how do you make this happen. And very core to that model that I started off with, we talked about the industry partnerships as being key. And the key thing when you start talking about industry partnerships within Rochester clearly comes down to you need proximity to the Mayo Clinic, you need access to Mayo researchers and faculty, and you need the ability to do joint development and the sharing of facilities in order to make this happen. So as the facilities committee looked at where should a campus such as this be located, how should it fit together, they looked at a number of options, but it kept coming back down to the fact that you needed the proximity to Mayo in order to make this work. And just to give you some background, I've worked with Mayo long enough to know that the core researchers and the people that drive Mayo Clinic are the physicians. If you aren't seeing patients 50% of the time at Mayo as an MD, you aren't a real doctor in their culture. So in order to make this work, it has to be convenient. Our researchers, the people who are going to drive the technology, are also the ones that are seeing patients in the morning. So proximity to Mayo Clinic is paramount to what we're doing, and it also gives us the capability to quite easily offer things such as joint professorships between this University of Minnesota campus as well as the Mayo Medical School.
And now we move into how we're going to fund it. It's an investment for the future. Mike?
Mr. Chairman, Mike Beckett, I'm a member of the Rochester Higher Education Development Committee and also the former chair of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Okay.
Thank you. It's always about the money, isn't it? What I want to talk about today is the fact that we are leveraging off the existing investments in Rochester. This is not coming from a dead start. We're also talking about an investment in the future as we leverage off of this. We are talking about envisioning to be the dollars come in is to be new money at the higher education system and to be identified and managed uniquely for that purpose. In addition to the commitment here, And for the facilities, Rochester has agreed to put up to one-third investment in the facilities through their sales tax revenues that has already been designated for higher education. We've already have a huge in-kind support from Mayo and IBM. We also have a huge investment in 10 endowed scholarships of $25,000 each before we even begin private fundraising in this process. The committee has also directed the UMR to begin now with a program of planning funds of $2.5 million appropriated in the 2005 legislature. And this will be used to start the technology commercialization office at the UMR immediately. Allied health programs will be the first to come online, and the Minnesota Allied Health Center will be a statewide collaborative effort in Rochester and the Twin Cities, and Minsky and the U of M will be partnering on this effort. There is a new articulation agreement between the two systems. Again, in conclusion, this is leveraging off the existing investment and also an investment in the future. This is not a cost. This should be viewed as an investment and a return, a huge investment that's already there. This leverage investment, one that takes advantage of existing resources within the community and has the capacity for spectacular returns. The state of Arizona projects that their investments in the biosciences will return $6 for every dollar invested. This investment will create new and unique value not only for the state, but for the country. This investment is entirely new. This is a continuation and focusing of a path that has been taken, that is talked about and approved several times over the last decade. So this investment creates a new value that is fully in alignment with the university's, Minnesota's goal of becoming a top three research university. It holds great promise to attract significant public and private research investment, and it leverages off of the investment and also leverages off the partnership with Minsky.
So what are the next steps?
Could I just ask you to move the microphone back?
I'm sorry, I didn't keep up with my duty.
Thank you very much.
Well, we ask that the Rochester community, the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Legislature, and the governor all partner to adopt the recommendations of the Rochester Higher Education Development Committee. We ask that you support the implementation of our recommendations, including programmatic growth and securing incremental funding. We ask that you work in partnership with the Rochester Higher Education Development Committee and Rochester community leaders to capitalize on the unique resources and opportunities in Rochester for the advancement of economic development in Minnesota. The Rochester Higher Education Development Committee report has been presented to the Governor, to the University of Minnesota Board of Regents, the Rochester City Council, the Rochester Area Economic Development Board, the Minsky Board of Trustees, the I-90 Legislators Coalition, and a lot of other Rotary Clubs, and you name it. It has received very positive response each time. The University of Minnesota Board of Regents has approved unanimously the recommendations of the Rochester Higher Ed Development Committee report. The Rochester City Council has dedicated $11.3 million in sales tax funds for UMR growth and capital expenditures. Our Rochester area state legislators have given unanimous, nonpartisan support to our report. And just yesterday, the Minnesota Senate Education Committee approved the bill authorizing the implementation of the Rochester Higher Ed Development Committee report, another unanimous vote. I have given you in your packets the letters of support from our Minsky partners from the University of Minnesota. I've given you copies of the resolutions which were adopted unanimously both by the Rochester City Council and the Board of Regents. We are here to ask for your support and your commitment to pass the bill authorizing the expansion of the University of Minnesota in Rochester. Not a new four-year university of any kind. This is an expansion of the University of Minnesota in Rochester with a $5 million grant in 2006 and a total of $16.3 million over the next 3 years. The time is now to advance Minnesota. This is critical economic development for our state's future. And I thank you for inviting us today.
Thank you for coming. Looking for questions, Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, just a couple of questions. This could be Representative Bradley or Ms. Stewart or former Trustee Vekich. Can you tell me how much the report cost? I didn't find a cost of the report anywhere in the copy, Ms. Stewart, that you sent to my home or in the website version of the report. So can you tell me how much this report that we're looking at cost?
I don't have a final cost.
I bring it up because we do have a statutory...
Chair Norness, Representative Pulaski. I do not have a final cost. We were given $200,000 in the legislation, and we have used some of those funds for hiring consultants, we have in process an economic impact study by Simon Tripp of Tripp Economics out of Pittsburgh. That's not quite finished. I don't have the final total for you at this point. Do you?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski. We don't have the full cost here, but as was indicated, we had about $200,000 in total. We had about $25,000 for the contract with one of our consultants, and we have another contract for approximately $50,000 on an economic study. So the total dollars will be well within what's appropriated for the study.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vekich, if it's $50,000, I just have another question, and maybe you can't answer it, but considering that this is such an important document, why is it that we had to use tax money for this report? Why isn't Rochester couldn't have come up with that sum of money and issued the report last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Why is it the tax dollars had to fund this report?
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, I hope we emphasize enough times that this really is a Minnesota investment. And just like legislators make all kinds of proposals that we ask taxpayers to invest, Rochester has invested considerably in other things, but it came before. We had hearings, the bills were here, and I think we sold it well, the people here sold it well, that this is an important investment, and it's an investment on behalf of Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, I don't doubt that. I'm asking the question that a community that is as wealthy and as populous as Rochester couldn't have come up with. But I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Pulaski.
It's been repeatedly stated in this report that the private sector commitment is a redirection of a local option sales tax. And the number that I think Mr. Vekich used was $11.3 million. Can you tell, first of all, a private sector commitment to me would be private sector. It would be the entities who are involved in this. It would be Mayo, it would be IBM, or it would be one of the private sector entities that would be coming up with the money. But can you tell me this redirection of the local option sales tax? Is the language already in the local option sales tax that this money can be redirected toward this?
We'd like to address that.
Chair Norris. Representative Pulaski, when the sales tax bill was passed, it did dedicate specific funds for higher education. And transportation was the other.
Mr. Chair, if I could also clarify it to Representative Pulaski, it's very clear in the language that the money can only be used for capital investments. This proposal before is strictly operational program growth. There may be in the future, and that's kind of why we're setting aside the possibilities of structures and capital investment, and that's why it's being set aside, but that would be a proposal that would have to come back to this body as well, but it's not in this proposal.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, the local option sales tax is solely for capital, not for operational.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, that's absolutely right.
And that would mean a building or buildings of some sort, or perhaps the maintenance of current structures that could be renovated.
Representative Bradley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, it would have to be a qualified capital investment project.
Then, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, and I'm clear that there is no other private sector commitment here from any of the entities that you mentioned that would benefit from this. There's no requirement in here that any entity that's going to benefit from all of this will contribute any of its resources toward it.
Mr. Chair, I make one comment at least. If you did, as I did, sat through, and this is just one example, through the hours and hours of meetings that went on, the individuals from those organizations were very active participants. The brain power that was brought to the table, if you had to pay for that, would be very significant. And that's just one example. I think there's been considerable in-kind contributions that have been made for many, many years to higher education in Rochester.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am not critical of the in-kind contributions that have been made. I am looking at this report and the projection of a U of M Rochester branch and what is required in this report. But I want to go to one more question, Mr.
Pagan-Pulowski.
You've mentioned repeatedly that this is not duplication. What in this report would prohibit duplication? Now, you have Lunskew. You have private colleges, St. Mary's, St. Thomas. You have your own community college, your own technical college. You have the University of Minnesota with a whole plethora of programs. What would prevent duplication other than you saying it?
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulowski, well, first of all, of course, we are talking about a very small amount of money, and if you saw the kinds of things that were being proposed here, that doesn't leave a whole lot of room to go around scavenging for a lot of things that are duplication, number one. Number two, you ought to be really encouraged by the support from the Minsky system, from the University of Minnesota system, by the president of Winona State University. They have been partners in this and are very strong supporters of it, and I think it would be also stewards along the way in supporting it. Their support's not given lightly, and I think that they would be very good stewards in trying to be sure that that we don't do anything in terms of duplication that doesn't make sense.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Pulowski,
this doesn't necessarily go to Representative Bradley, but my concern is repeatedly I've been told that this is new money. And new money in the legislature that we have had since 03, when both the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system received record-based cuts, and there is in no fashion a restoration of those record-based cuts, when the students of both systems have had record tuition increases, record debt now on all of those students. The statement that this is somehow new money, when we haven't restored what we've cut from these systems, it baffles me a little bit. I'm wondering why we should proceed, and I'm not questioning what you have on this PowerPoint, but I'm questioning why, when we haven't funded current programs where there is demonstrative need, I'll just take nursing as one example, how we would move forward with something new when we have underfunded and cut the needs of programs that already exist, either in the University of Minnesota or the Minsky side. You don't necessarily need to answer. It's just an observation.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it does at least call for an answer, and I can only give you the best that I possibly can. Part of it would be to repeat what I said, and that is that those institutions that you just mentioned have shown their support. That's one thing. And the other is, even in those courses, before this legislature, we have University of Minnesota proposals. We will continue to make, notwithstanding what may have happened in the past, strategic investments. And this is a strategic investment of a relatively small amount. Mr. Chair, before I leave, though, I did forget, when we were making introductions, I want to acknowledge that the legislative team from the Rochester area has worked very closely together. I don't think that Representative Demmer is able to be here because he had another committee.
He did stop here.
Oh, Representative Demmer is here. Well, okay, good. And Representative Liebling and Representative Welty are here as well, and I want to acknowledge their presence and to thank them very much for the hard work that we've all done together.
Okay, I have a question from Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, kind of a free market guy in some areas. Some people think I'm not, but if you don't have students, if this doesn't work out the way you think it's gonna move, I'm assuming that it would morph into some other area that maybe there would be interest or something. I mean, I didn't hear anybody talk about that. You're not concerned that people aren't going to be interested in attending this institution.
Who wants to answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, I'll just make my very optimistic answer. Because I think what Mr. Flotta reviewed tells you about the tremendous potential, so I'm every bit optimistic, and we are talking about a small amount. The other thing you have to understand, of course, is that this money flows into the systems and is controlled by the University of Minnesota and our system, and they are stewards of it. This in the almost 0% probability it doesn't fly, then I think the University of Minnesota, because this is really the University of Minnesota, will be here telling us that. But I think they'll be here telling us, wow, was it successful?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Carlson.
Chairman, if someone either at the table or maybe from the university could give us a snapshot of what the governance structure is going to be. I'm looking at the first paragraph of the bill, and you know, originally it talks about a non-residential branch. Now all of that is struck, and it becomes, or it says the Board of Regents may establish a branch campus of the university. And I would be interested in just what that governance structure is going to look like.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record, please.
Robert J. Jones, Senior Vice President for System Academic Administration, University of Minnesota. Chair, known as Representative Carlson, the governance structure will essentially be the University of Minnesota's current governance structure, which is the Board of Regents. As I think was indicated, or at least as we've stated several times in the past, the degrees that will be granted by the University of Minnesota Rochester will essentially be Twin Cities-based degrees, as other degrees are within the current system.
Mr. Chairman, maybe before we wander too far that way, I understand that from the testimony. I'm talking about the, when I'm saying governance structure, I know it'll be under the Board of Regents and what have you, but what will be the administrative structure then? Let me phrase it that way. In Rochester, and how does that differ from what was or what you're doing currently and under current law versus what will be then a it appears a full branch of the university.
Chair Nornis, Representative Carlson, the administrative structure that's already in place with the current operation, we don't envision any changes in the administrative structure. As you know, Provost David Carl is the chief academic officer for that campus. We will continue in that role. We have not at this juncture, until such time one would amass the kinds of academic programs or the number of academic programs, a substantial increase in the number of student body, the current structure we think will continue to serve the institution well. So we have in the short term at least, any need to change the current administrative structure.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, that gets at the question I was asking.
Thank you. Anyone else like to testify on this bill, for or against? If not, again, renew my motion that House File 3607 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Vote on that. We don't need to vote on that. Okay. Then we'll lay it over. Possible inclusion. Yes.
Can I just ask a question on your motion? Will there be an omnibus hiring bill?
At this point, Representative Blowski, we are hoping and planning on one.
So, Mr. Chair, I asked the question several times last week, and then it was no. So now we're hoping on one.
It's more than a maybe.
It's more than a maybe. Let's put on the maybe just for a second. Maybe how much money might be in it.
Maybe. We're not optimistic that it'll be a lot. The governor has the Rochester funding in his budget. I'm guessing that would be the minimum that we'd be looking at.
Okay.
And beyond that, I'm not sure.
Chairman, on that point, you were probably in Ways and Means this morning, as I was, and we had a discussion here the other day. The motion that comes out of Ways and Means endorsing the House budget resolution is again at $88 million, which is $109 million below the governor's recommendation. Our caucus continued today to press. Well, what are the priorities within that? What will be the individual committee targets? And we're not yet told what those will be, but I think it has to be understood by everybody at the table here and those people that are advocates in the audience that $109 million below the governor means that there's going to be obviously some major shifts in what the governor's recommendations were. Now, whether this is going to be one of those shifts or not, I don't know. Your signal seems to be you'll have some money. Maybe. Yeah. But I think for the audience to know, and that was the debate on the House floor, by the way, the other day when many of us rejected the first budget resolution because we had no idea what the various targets were going to be.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. And next bill up today is, before we get to that, let's, I need a motion to approve the minutes from the March 27th committee meeting. Representative Haas moves that the minutes be approved for Monday, May the 27th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Members, next we have House Files 3924.
Would you?
I didn't think it was. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Hang on. I will.
Thank you.
This is the Office of Higher Education bill, which I'm proud to author.
But is this the one we had the other day? We have. Is that different? Well, that's in here. Okay, because some of it looks amazing. Yeah. Okay. This is one. Okay.
Welcome to the committee. If you're prepared to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Susan Hegart. I'm the Director of Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And with me today, I have Mark Michikanis. He's our Director of Research and Fiscal Policy. We're basically going to walk through the bill. My question is, are you using the summary document? How would you... I think our summary follows yours. Would you prefer that we just walk through the summary?
That should work.
Okay. And we need to talk about money, even though money's not mentioned in here. There are some fiscal implications in what we'll be talking about, so we'll talk about that as well. Basically, the first few sections relate to changes in the public post-secondary systems reporting on instructional expenditures and finance, and I'd ask Mr. and Mrs. Michikanis to take the first three sections that relate to finance.
I don't think we moved the bill. I forgot to do that. So we'll move House File 3924 and to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Now you may continue.
Mr. Chairman and members, the first three sections of the bill and a number of appealers relate to a report that was issued back in January 15th of this year. That report came out of a directive that was in the Conference Committee report last year, adopted, of course, by both bodies. And there was a review of the enrollment adjustment to the base of the two public higher education systems. And Mr. Chair, I can just speak to these points. I'm not sure if you wanted me to talk about the report itself. I think each member got a report at some point, a copy of one. But just in a kind of summary then, the sections you see in front of you were sections of the current law that were amended. One changed the reporting process a bit to expand it to include our office and the Department of Finance, and to actually tighten up a little bit so that to the extent that we ask for data from the two public systems, there's a process that we go through to make sure that it's relevant, that the public institutions have some input into the whole process of why we would request it in the first place. The second section dealing with the operating budget, one of the recommendations in the report did call for the continuation of the two public systems to make separate presentations to the legislature on the budget requests. As you know, that they are treated somewhat differently than most other state agencies or state-related agencies. In the case of the University of Minnesota, where they have the capacity to make requests, to present the requests outside the governor's budget. That is continued in the recommendation of the report, and that would be the same as in Section 2. What's being struck is a reference to the 67% that's in current law as a part of the policy for funding higher education.
Representative Pulaski?
Mr. Chair, this is, you can correct me, it would be interesting. Is this the remainder of the funding formula for Minsky and the university that's being struck at this point?
Sure, and Representative Pulaski, it is almost in totality the remainder of the current funding formula, and that was a recommendation of the task force that was put together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, in Ms. Hegarter, it's curious that this is being struck, and when we repealed the section last year, I believe we put a drop dead at 07, didn't we? Is it July 1st, 07?
That's true.
So why would we be striking this now and striking the other part later? Why would we be doing them simultaneously? It's just a curiosity of mine to wonder why we're not doing them both at the same time.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pulaski, the way it works is that these are base adjustments. So the way the Department of Finance, I believe, would treat this in the forecast for the 08-09 biennium is as if it were struck now. The dates of the effective dates don't have all that much relevancy.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Pulaski,
if these are stricken and there is no formula to replace them, is there a base cut to these systems?
The way it would work in the future is that the base would be determined under Chapter 16A the way it is for all other state agencies. It essentially is the appropriation for the second year of the previous biennium. So the appropriation for fiscal 07.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Scott, my concern is this. If enrollment continues to increase through 07-08, there's no recognition then of those new students. I'm just going to take the Minsky system. So is that a base cut if there isn't anything to replace this language?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, I mean, that is the current law. There is no adjustment for enrollment future.
Well, I know that. After that was taken out.
Yes.
If there's nothing to replace that, these systems are getting a base cut. There's no recognition of new enrollment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, under the recommendations of the task force, there is no recommendations for any changes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
A couple of points. Could you refresh my memory in terms of who was on the task force? That would be one question. And then secondly, on that 07 question that Representative Pulaski just raised, was that an actual discussion item in terms of the repeal of 07, being that that was something that was just agreed to by the legislature? Where they really talked about that issue? And I guess then my third question as a follow-up, I noticed finance nodding their head. The law was going to be 07, and you just told me they were going to ignore the state law. That seems to be an interesting question in my mind. Maybe you want to clarify. You're saying no. What do you mean? If the state law is that it's not repealed until 07, why isn't the budget built around current law?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, and Representative Carlson, the way the base adjustment would work is, since we're already into the 06-07 biennium, is for future biennium. It's for 08 and 09. And that language would be in effect for that period of time. So it has no relevancy for the current biennium, since you've already adopted the appropriations. These are adjustments to the base for future years. So I'm not suggesting at all that they ignore the law. I'm simply suggesting that it wouldn't have effect for the So you're talking about.
Sure, you're talking about the future biennium then as you put the budget together. Well, then it does raise those important questions that Representative Pawlowski was pointing out. Well, thank you.
Ms. Novak has a comment.
Oh, I guess I had other parts of the question, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Can Ms. Novak respond?
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Nishikanis has explained, this bill repeals the remaining sections of the part that was known as appropriations for instruction. Something like that, close enough. but it also repeals the amended sections that were passed last year. So in effect, it takes care of all, the entire base funding adjustment is gone with this bill.
All right.
Representative Carlson, did you have something for them?
Well, I had one time saw the list that was on the, that made the recommendations. Maybe that was a fairly long list. I can wait. Maybe it can be provided.
Mr. Chair, it's actually, I think, opposite report are coming around. It's on page three, or page five, rather.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. Thank you.
I have a question of either Ms. Seagard or we have an amendment. Should that be acted on before we go any further? Or I don't know who's. Who's offering the amendment? Is it? You want to wait with that?
Mr. Chair, the amendment pertains to a point a little bit later in the bill. You might want to, it's up to you, but you might want us to have us talk about the bill,
okay.
And then I could reference the amendment at the
right.
appropriate
Very
time.
Ms. Thomas, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and members, actually, Representative Carlson had one more question. I thought about the initial discussion in the group about the enrollment adjustment, and at the first meeting it did come up, whether it was the right thing to do, continuation of services, I think going to Representative Pawlowski's issue as well. So that was discussed right at the front end. And as the work developed through the course of the three public meetings that were held and a number of smaller working group meetings, I think it was the determination of the group, and certainly both systems were well represented at the group. It was their sense that the action that had been taken place by the legislature last year was the correct one, and that the recommendations you have in the report and that are contained in the bill, as reflected by the report, was, I would suggest, consensus amongst everybody in the group.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, I don't mean this in a flippant way, but I don't represent systems. I represent campuses and students who pay these bills and carry the debt. So while the report is a report, I'm here representing them, not the system, to make it perfectly clear.
Mr. Chairman, so if I could follow up on that question of who was on, and you indicated that there was consensus. Now, there's different definitions of consensus, at least in my mind. Is there actually a vote on this report then? And if so, was that by give me your definition of consensus, whatever that agreement was?
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Carlson. Just to point, be very clear that Jim Nobles is. Legislative auditor was on the group as a non-voting member, so we had intended should votes be taken. As the report was developed through the course of the summer and the fall, between people, the budget officers at the Minsky System and the University of Minnesota, it was shared with the group at all times, and the final report was sent to everybody, and essentially, I would say, a vote by... there was not a meeting where there was an actual vote taken. But everybody was given the opportunity to affirm the final report in the state that it was in. And we did, through an email process, we got emails back from members of the group that said that they affirmed the report.
So they voted they actually cast, Mr. Chairman, a vote via email where they affirmed it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson is correct.
And that passed Mr. Noble's critique of voting? I just remember he did a report on the Board of Regents one time. It was very critical of how they voted by nodding their heads. That was at the height of the Ken Keller issues, but so that passed muster with him then. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Daniel?
I think, Mr. Chair, that fairly summarizes those first three sections. Section 3, again, is just another part of the report. And the language that's stricken there is reflects
that.
Question.
Representative Pulaski has a question.
Mr. Chair, in Section 3, the language that's stricken deals with accountability, and it deals with it at the system and campus or to measure performance. Doesn't your office have $300,000 a year to measure accountability? And now we strike the language for accountability. Is there a contradiction there, or what's going on?
Mr. Chair, as a congressman, Pulaski, what's being struck there? That sentence in that section is being struck because of the reference to 135A033, which is being repealed.
Okay.
So since the cross-reference is in there, in the repealed section, it was about to take.
Well, Mr. Chair, my concern is that we're just not wasting $300,000. We're still doing accountability and measuring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, yes, to your point, there was $100,000 for the first year and then $300,000 for the second. We've contracted with the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, NCHEMS. I know they've done work with a number of institutions around the state, and some of you are familiar with them, but we've contracted with them. We've had several public meetings and then some meetings around the state, and we're expecting a final report from them shortly.
All right. Thank you.
All right, so we're at Section 4.
Section 4 of the bill, Mr. Chair, definition of eligible institutions for the state grant program. The proposal that we have before you is to require institutions to participate in the federal Title IV student aid programs. Without going into great detail about that, what happens is at the federal level, they have certain requirements of schools in order for those schools to get federal money, such as a Pell Grant. Their budget standards sort of built into Title IV. You have to have the administrative capacity to protect, you know, students, et cetera, taxpayer dollars, and that's why that's in place. One of the practical effects is that you could have a student attending a federal Title IV school. They could qualify for a state grant, but they couldn't qualify for a Pell Grant and or a federal loan, for that matter. And so that's sort of the practical effect of this. But one of the concerns we have, there'd be about 16 schools affected. They're smaller. Three-quarters of them are probably cosmetology schools. But, for example, we had a school that opened and shut down, you know, in 1 year. And I guess our feeling is that at our agency, we want to make sure that the taxpayer's dollar is protected. Among our many responsibilities, we want to watch the taxpayer's dollar. And so we feel that this is a sort of a fiscally responsible thing to ask of schools. There's a three-year phase-in period, so the impact is not automatic. They've got a period of time in which to move in this direction. And I guess I'd like to say here that if you're not ready to go this far, if you're concerned, for example, about the impact on small businesses, there might be a step that might not be quite so dramatic that we could take as an interim move, but it still wouldn't, those students wouldn't get the federal money if you took sort of that interim step, something like requiring accreditation or asking them to be in business for a year or so. So that's why we're putting this forward and would ask your support for that. There is a fiscal impact. There'd be some students that wouldn't be getting state grants because there'd be less students affected, correct? So we've internally noted that this would be about $400,000 a year. There's another provision in the bill that I'm going to talk about next that kind of roughly nets out that impact. Section 5, definition of Minnesota resident for the state grant program. Basically, this would make active duty military personnel stationed in Minnesota and their spouses and children eligible for state grants. Currently, they're not. In addition, the amendment would make students relocated to Minnesota because of national disasters and legal political refugees relocated to Minnesota eligible for state grants. These three changes would slightly increase the number of students eligible for the grant program. The fourth change would apply to students who graduate from Minnesota high schools and then move to another state. Those students would qualify for state grants as Minnesota residents only if they return to Minnesota to attend classes here. Our concern, of course, is online learning, not having somebody take advantage of the program, for example, at a distance. So I think we were before you last year with something sort of similar. We think that's important. And the amendment that you referenced, Mr. Chair, correct, is the A3 amendment. And what we wanted to do is tighten up this up just a little bit. On page 3, line 19, after months, insert if the disaster interrupts the student's post-secondary education. We want to make sure there was a nexus between, you know, the disaster and the fact that the student's education was interrupted in order for them to get the grant.
Okay, I'll move the A3 amendment. Any discussion or question?
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
I had one more point. The fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I forgot to just mention that. This would increase slightly the state grant program. At an average state grant of about $2,000 a student, spending would increase by about $100,000 in FY07. And there's room in the current appropriation to absorb that increase, Mr. Chair.
Need to vote on the amendment. Again, the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is approved.
Section 6 is really the same thing that I was talking about earlier for the grant program, the Title IV, but it relates to the self-loan program. It would say that if you want to get a self-loan, you have to be a Title IV, a federal Title IV school participant. The same thing with Section 7, the definition of a Minnesota resident student, it applies for the self-loan program. Section 8, eligible co-signer for self-loans. I want to talk a little bit about that and why we're moving forward with this particular recommendation. We're putting the co-signer requirements that were in rule into law and adding requirement that a co-signer be 24 years or older. Those of you who know about co-signers, you know that when you co-sign a loan, you're as liable as the individual taking out the loan. So we take that very, very seriously, and we want students to be sure to do that as well. We're also adding authority for the office to use credit scores as a measure of creditworthiness. Just a couple talking points on the age of the co-signers, because I know some of the students have expressed some concern about this. For 18 to 23-year-olds right now in financial aid, we consider them dependent on their parents and use their parents' financial information. So after age 23, that's when we begin to use the student's own information. And a lot of students don't have a financial credit history yet until they're independent themselves and they begin working. Roommates or friends co-sign loans for each other. Some may not have a long-term commitment to one another. They may actually not even know each other after they're in school. So that's a heavy responsibility for a roommate to bear, we think, to co-sign a loan for their roommate. And as I mentioned, 18 to 23-year-olds often lack a credit history, so they can't always provide verifiable financial security for the loan. So I guess we're trying to watch out, protect the co-signer as well. And I know you're going to hear from the students, and we're willing to work with them on this, but I think we feel pretty strongly that this is important to do. Interest rate swaps, I'll ask Mr. Canis to talk to you about that.
Mr. Chair, members, this has to do with the self-loan program. We had conversations with a number of the financial advisors and investment bankers that are involved with us in these programs. They've recommended to us this, it's interest rate swaps is the title of it, but it's simply a marketing tool that we would use. It's fairly complicated, trading off variable rate instruments with fixed rate instruments. Currently, Housing Finance Agency has this authority, and a few years ago, the Public Facilities Authority was given the same, granted this same authority. Housing Finance, I note, in the conversation with Tanya Orr just last week, has been using it with some regularity, although I'm not sure to what extent. Our sense here is that if the market for student loans is competitive, and if we want this program to be successful, that this may be one tool to help us create actual savings for students. It's not our intent to use this in any great detail. The way we've kind of thought about it is we need to learn more about it, and perhaps one way to do that is to get into the market in a very small way. Again, it's just simply ways to reduce interest costs in the end to students.
Section 10 pertains to classification of data. Right now, and I didn't know this, even though I've been on the job a couple of years, I'm still learning things, I didn't realize that the names and addresses of state grant recipients are public information. Most of our data is private, but there's some exceptions, and this falls under one of them. And there's been one education organization that over the years has requested the data file, and that would be all 70,000 students, public and private. It's not separated out at all. It's just an entire data file. So what really, and so we had this proposal because I think we're concerned. We received our first non-education request very recently, non-education organization request. That alarmed me, to be frank with you. And I guess the concern, of course, is that credit card companies, loan companies, et cetera, would have access to this information. You would be able to know, you know, these students are from families making roughly $70,000-ish or less, primarily the lower middle income, lower income families. And so we're asking that these names and addresses be made private. We could still provide the information in a summary fashion for the institutions that are interested in getting it. You know, if they wanted to know what county students were in, kind of what the breakdown was in terms of who gets loans at what level, we could still provide that information. We've written the Attorney General for an opinion on this recently, and also asked for clarification from the Department of Education, because certain education organizations are covered by the acronym FERPA. It's the Federal Privacy Act. And our agency, which I don't know why, but it has not ever sought direction on this before from the federal government. So I just wanted to...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carter.
Can I ask, I concur with the comments you're making about credit card companies and so on, but you did indicate that historically one educational group, I think you said, had been requesting the information, so we kind of know what we're doing. It sounds like there may be a bit of a two-edged sword here. What educational group would that be then that would no longer be able to get the information?
I don't know. I guess the requester's name isn't private. The Private College Council has requested information on the state grant program, but the first non-education related organization was not a higher education related organization at all, and that was what really raised the concern for me. So, for example, we've talked with the private colleges and we've said, look, you know, we can provide the summary information for you in a way that would still, we think, be workable for the information that they need in terms of kind of understanding where the breakdown is geographically, you know, for the grant program and anybody else who'd want to have that information.
One of the reasons, Mr. Chairman, I raised that question, and I, so long ago, I don't recall the detail of it, but at one time, the legislature made a request of legislative staff to do a study, and we had some difficulty getting information due to privacy laws at that point in time, and I just hope that what you're talking about then is an appropriate blend with that summary so that when we're making decisions about financial aid as a legislative body, that we're going to be able to get the information that we need. And like I say, I concur when you get credit card companies and so on. Maybe I'm one that's burned out like everybody in the room here. You know, it seems like every day in the mail you're getting something from these credit card companies. Where they get the list with my name, I don't know. But I can certainly see where students are probably barraged and, you know, would concur that an entity like that probably should be restricted. But just so we, you know, that's a very large appropriation, and just so we can get the information we need to make good public policy decisions, I don't know if we need to have language in there that clarifies that or not, but it's important. You know, if you continue on as chair and you at some point have some, you know, good basic questions about financial aid and its distribution and income levels, at least in a general way, that we can get all that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, Ms. Grimes has just reassured me that the language is still in the bill that would allow legislative staff to get that information if they needed it. And we can also, if there is an education organization or anybody else who wants summary data, you know, the demographer's office, any, you know, the U of M, anybody who wanted it, we could still give summary information that was relevant. But I'm assured that there's language that allows legislative staff, et cetera, to get that information if they need it. Our goal is not to keep the good policy, you know, information from you. It's just to protect the students from being
I understand that. Mr. Chairman, I assume that's not your goal. I just want to make sure that the language reflects that so that... we did have some difficulty, some misunderstandings years ago when we were trying to acquire information, and maybe our staff can check current law, make sure that it's built in, that we can get that kind of information should we ever want to acquire that information for our decision-making purposes.
Representative Carlson and other members, you might be interested to know we received two credit card offers for this committee this week.
Even the committee?
Yeah.
You must be planning on traveling, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that there's a reference in another piece of part of law of the statute, And I think that's a good idea. If there, if your staff could take a look at that, that would probably be very helpful. But it's in another part of law, apparently, that allows legislative staff to get that information if you need it.
Okay. We are, oh, we got one other question. Representative Lance.
My question's been answered.
Okay, thank you.
Is
he there? Oh, Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking about your, the, back on page 5, line 3, you were talking about the credit scoring and the may establish credit scoring and that sort of thing. Is that, tell, is there, what is the repayment experience now on the three loans? And,
is it going?
I guess I'd like Mr. Miscanis to answer that, or we may have another person on our staff who could answer that question.
Reverend Morris and Mr. Eastland. Actually, the default rate on the cell phone program is extremely low. If that's your question.
I'm looking at the credit scoring
Representative Eastland.
On page 5. I mean, I guess I think that was a reading of the co-signer. Co-signing loans and that sort of thing. I mean, you were saying it says the office may establish alternative credit requirements using credit scoring, and so just relative to that, I was asking what is the current experience of the repayment of loans that would be using credit, we'd now be using credit scoring to be a criteria for.
Welcome to the committee, and I'd please identify yourself.
Yes, Cheryl Maplethorpe with the Office of Higher Education. We are requesting that currently the person has to be creditworthy, and we define that in different ways. One way is to ask for a personal financial statement where they just fill out the assets they have, and we take a look at that. Going to a credit score can make that more automated so that we can make a decision more quickly. As Mark said, our experience in the self-loan area in general is that our default rate is very low. People repay their debt, so that is not that much concern. This just simply makes it a smoother process, a more automated process.
Yeah, I mean, I guess
on the beast one,
Mr. Chair, and I guess that's why I thought I understand that. And when you say you may establish... does that mean this is going to happen in a year or 2 years or 3 years? It's imminent to happen. It's just a matter of time. Or
it gives It gives us the permission to look at that and to see if we can automate it and make it a smoother process. It's not a promise that it will be done, and there's no particularly deadline in there.
So then, when people don't score high enough, is there, this is an issue that happens all over the place. You know, people who are, if they haven't used, I mean, your score can be all over the map for a variety of reasons, a lot of which have not a whole lot to do with your credit worthiness. And I would question why we would go to a system that's more automated that I think really is going to provide less individuality and service to the people that we're servicing if we don't have a real problem with our loan repayment at this point then.
Okay. Chair Nonis and Member Eastland, I understand your point, I guess is all I can say.
Representative Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to second what Representative Eastland said in that regard and express my concerns on that as well. But I have... another question or two, just so I understand this. I'm sorry if you've already covered some of this, but I was thinking about another question while you've been talking about some of this. On lines 4.23 to 4.31 regarding creditworthiness, for line 4.24 it says no credit bureau balance is discharged through bankruptcy. Would that mean that say if an eligible if a co-signer were proposed to be a parent or an uncle or an aunt or something like that, and if they had 15 or 20 years earlier gone through bankruptcy and had some credit bureau balances discharged, that they would not be eligible to co-sign the loan for their niece or nephew or child?
Who wants to answer that question?
Chair Nornes and Member Lapp, we just got some information that apparently bankruptcy discharges don't show up on a credit card, or sorry, on the credit report after about 7 years. Also, in general, educational debt cannot be discharged through bankruptcy.
Then, if you're only dealing with bankruptcies for the past 7 years, then this language ought to be corrected to reflect that. Because this language right now doesn't say if it shows up on a credit bureau report. It just says no bankruptcies. So, I guess I'd move to amend the language to say no credit bureau balance is discharged through bankruptcy within the 7 years prior to the application for credit or something like that.
Mr. Chair, we'd be amenable to that suggestion. Thank you.
Does Novak, do you have that language? Does everyone understand? Do you want to make an official motion to amend?
So moved.
Anyone have a question? All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Another Representative Lance.
Thank you. And Ms. Hegart, I'm trying to understand also what line 4.26 exactly means, especially in comparison to subclause 3 and subclause 4. Delinquent or unsatisfied credit obligation, is that, it says such as tax and mechanics liens or judgments, but what about credit card balances? Is that covered on subclause 3, or is that something that is on subclause 4, current credit bureau balances?
Ms. Hegart?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lotz, I think that, I think the such as was just meant to give some examples. I'm guessing that it falls under sub 3, but I'd have to check back with our staff in the office to just confirm that. Where would credit card balances show up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lotz. That was my reading, although I wasn't quite sure what a credit bureau balance is in subclause 4. But it simply says, certainly if you have a credit card, it is a credit obligation. And so that would suggest then at the time someone applies to be a cosigner on a loan, that if they are 1 day past a $100 credit card balance, they are not eligible. Because if you read lines 4.29 to 4.31, there's a $50 exception. Well, you know, $50 could be one restaurant dinner for two people, let alone a family of four. And all of a sudden, the credit card bill gets stuck under a pile on their desk, and all of a sudden, they can't co-sign the loan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lapp, you know, I'd have to go back to our office and double-check, but this is all language that's been in rule for years. That's my understanding. It's now being brought into...
that language.
Right, I understand that. But I think I need to go back and talk with the people that have the expertise in this particular area to find out more about that. But your specific question, as I understand it, is what happens with a credit card balance, small credit card balance, for example, does that prevent someone from... being able to apply or get one of these loans. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Eastland? Were you finished, Representative Lance?
Well, just to ask Mr. Chairman that the results of Ms. Hegard's inquiries in her office be shared with us before we consider any bill that this might get rolled into.
I expect, Mr. Chair, Representative Lutz, that we could get back to you, you know, by tomorrow with a response on this.
If you could get a written response to the committee and distribute it to the committee, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Eastland.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the other thing I'd be concerned about is going back to the credit scoring. I mean, I understand how that works. Generally, when you automate, you kind of go to the simplest thing and the most turnkey way to kind of determine somebody's creditworthiness. But it would seem like to me that any policy that you establish and begin to move down the track of it, that you would create kind of a continuum of ways that people could qualify for credit, that this wouldn't become the benchmark. I think we've gone way too far down that road, kind of as an economic culture already. And in my view, those things are not really the best, always the best indicator of whether or not somebody is going to be able to manage their debt.
It's sort of the opinion of the chair that the folks that we're concerned about here probably aren't going to be real anxious to co-sign to take on more debt as well. So just take that into consideration. Representative Lance.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one additional thought on that, which is that, you know, typically if a credit card company or a mortgage banker is looking at a credit score to determine how to handle a loan, it may make someone ineligible for a loan, but quite often it may simply affect the interest rate on the loan. And yet here it's being proposed to make them ineligible for the loan altogether without any consideration of measuring the risk and adjusting interest rates to reflect that risk. So I'd urge great caution here. Might end up denying good students the opportunity to enroll in higher education.
Appreciate the questions. We have a ways to go yet before we're...
We do. Just one more point on that. To that point, I believe that our self-loan interest rate is the same for everyone. It's not a need-based loan. It's a loan that anyone can apply for who qualifies, but the interest rate doesn't float on that for the individual. Is that correct?
That's true. That is the case. It depends on where you, when you took the loan out, but the loan is the same regardless of your credit risk right now.
Okay, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just very quickly on this credit scoring, you know, there's been other committees in this legislative body that have debated that whole issue. It's very controversial. And why do you feel you even need that language? I would be tempted to recommend when the final bill is drafted or maybe even propose an amendment that we drop that line out of there. But I'd want to hear first why you feel credit scoring is necessary. I think this is an important enough issue, Mr. Chairman, to spend a minute or two on it, at least.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Carlson, perhaps I can respond, and I don't have full knowledge on this. But there, earlier in the process, we had considered using the absolute, referred to as a FICO score. It's not clear to me, but I think that there is more to credit scoring than just that single number, FICO score. And for that reason, this language is a little bit broader than we had considered earlier. But again, I'm not expert enough to know in any way what other kinds of credit-related information goes into credit scoring for say besides that FICO score.
Mr. Chairman, I...
Representative Carlson.
I'm concerned enough about that where I'd like to move that we strike that line 5.3. And, Mr. Chairman, if I may, if there's reasons at some point in the future where that might be necessary, but I think the testimony is such, and we know it's controversial enough in the legislature, I would hate to see us kind of plowing ahead with the limited amount of knowledge that we have here today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, would you be open to our at least checking back with our folks at the office and getting some history and background for you before we'd move to, you'd move to strike that? I mean... I'd like to just like to get some more information for you, and we could get that for you by tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman,
would you have the representative last say?
Okay,
you want to comment on that point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just as soon move ahead right now on the motion to strike, and if information comes forth that would make me comfortable putting it back in, then I'd be willing to consider that at the appropriate time. But that'd be my preference for whatever it's worth.
Do you have an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, I think as long as we'd have a chance in the future to just come forward if there's some additional information, you know, that would be helpful, I just would like that assurance. Then we're comfortable with motion.
So I just want to stay with it for the very points that Representative Black's made. I think we can always reconsider the issue, but I think it's important enough to maybe put the burden on putting it back in as opposed to having it in there and then having it pass by us in the future.
Okay, who made the motion, Carlson or Lyons? Okay, I forgot. Sort of a co-motion. I'll take credit.
Either way.
All those in favor of the amendment to delete that one line on 5.3, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's gone. Okay, let's... Section 9, is that where we are?
No,
Oh, we're beyond that.
Section 11. Mr. Chair, I know Representative Pawlowski's had some concerns, raised concerns about borrowing and student debt, but we're not trying to increase student debt in this section. The limits for self loans have not increased in over 10 years, and so one of the things that we're proposing to do here is that for first and second year students, the amount that they could borrow would increase from $4,500 to $6,000 per year starting in FY07. And then again, they could increase to $7,500 in FY09. As I mentioned, the limits haven't changed in over 10 years since 94.
Just one moment, Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out in the amendment that you adopted, there were actually some changes to the dates in this section that I believe were technical changes at the request of the office.
I'll back it up here. It was apparently it was backed up a year from fiscal 07 to fiscal 08, Mr. Chair. Then borrowing limits for students in their third through fifth years of enrollment would increase from the current $6,000 to $7,500 in FY. Would that be 08 then? Cumulative borrowing limits would increase correspondingly. The practical effect is that right now a student may have to take out two loans, one with a higher interest rate. This would allow a student to consolidate their loan. And have a lower interest rate.
I don't know what that was, but Representative Lance.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hegard, do you have any idea why we are establishing loan amounts and actions by statute as opposed to having some benchmark might float?
Mr. Chair, Representative Blatt, I ask Mr. Michikanis to comment on that.
Mr. Representative Blatt, these were in rule before, but as you know, rule making can actually be very time consuming. And I think I'm told that the last time the cash returns were increased, there was some objection to it on the part of some. And sometimes it's easier to come to you and make the case, the policy case to you, that it needs to be done than it may be to go through the rulemaking process.
Representative Lance.
My question really wasn't why rule or why statute instead of rule, but why specify it in statute as a dollar amount rather than, or why don't we put a COLA in there, or why don't we put something in there that benchmarks it against an interest rate that adjusts every 6 months or every year to reflect any changes in any benchmark interest rate or something like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lyons, certainly the private sector has unlimited caps in the alternative market. At the other extreme, the federal loan limits are lower than these. So this is kind of a middle ground. We're sitting seeking the authority. I'm not sure what kind of index I could think of that would index caps. Certainly interest rate, and our interest rate does change based on the market. Our interest rates on the loans are tied to called the LIBOR, the London Interbank loan rate. But so interest rates flow, but the caps, I think, are a little bit different. But it's it's something we can explore, but offhand it's hard to say.
Representative Weiss.
I would just ask, I'm thinking off the top of my head on this one, but I'd ask if you could just take a look at it and see if there's, rather than having to come back to the legislature,
every year, every 2 years, make adjustments. Maybe there's no reference point that would be able to take in the complexities of setting this kind of caps, and if that's the case, fine. But if you could take a look at it maybe and give us some feedback. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Watts, he'd be happy to do that as well.
We'll continue our meeting until we're done with the bill. Hopefully you can all stick around.
Section 12, repayment of self loans. Right now, a borrower with a self loan of $18,750 or more would have up to 15 years to repay their loans instead of the current 10-year term. So it just stretches out the repayment time a bit. In Section 13, this would delete the word province from the definition of eligible students. We know a lot about post-secondary institutions in Minnesota. We know little about institutions in Manitoba, so we felt that that was an appropriate change to make. Section 14, the cosigner requirement. Again, this section makes the cosigner jointly and severally responsible for repaying the loan. It puts loan language that's been in rule into statute. Section 15, loan rehabilitation for self loans. This authorizes our office to establish a loan rehabilitation program for defaulters who want to rehabilitate their loans. We think that's important, that if someone's fallen on a difficult time, that they have a chance to try to figure out a way to make repayment. Section 16, temporary total disability for self loans. Currently, the office forgives a loan for self borrowers who become totally and permanently disabled. However, some borrowers are only disabled for a few years and then develop the ability to return to work later. This would allow us to grant students a temporary total disability status for up to 3 years. And interest would not accrue during that. There'd be basically a grace period. Interest would not accrue during that time. But a doctor's documentation would be required. Section 17, state work study. State work study recipients have been eligible to receive work study earnings during one period of non-enrollment each year, usually during the summer. This language would extend that eligibility to students who enroll in courses on a less than half-time basis. There's no fiscal impact. The campus would distribute the work study monies to the campuses, as they've done for many years, and the campus would have to live within its means, basically, in terms of the funds. But it just gives some flexibility to campuses. And then sections 18 and 19 and 20 pertain to Rochester. I think you've heard that bill today, and I don't know if you need me to go through that again with you.
Is that it?
That's it.
That's it? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Remember.
Thank you. Russ Stanton would like to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Russ Stanton. I represent the Interfaculty Organization, which is the faculty, about 3,300 faculty at the seven state universities. I'm appearing here today to speak in opposition to Section 2 of the bill and also to Section 25, the repealer section of the bill. Section 2 of the bill essentially would do away with what's remaining of our state policy, which says that students should pay one-third of the cost of their instructional costs, and the state pays the other two-thirds. Of course, the remainder of the statute dealt with recognizing inflation and enrollment. It's been the stated policy of the state of Minnesota since 1983 that the students should pay one-third of the cost of their instruction and the state the other two-thirds. And in fact, before 1983, Representative Carlson would probably know this better than I, the ratio was even more favorable to the students. The students paid considerably less than a third of the cost of instruction. The state paid more. Now, that wasn't that part of the formula was not a hard and fast rule. In fact, in hard times, the state frequently deviated from the policy. And in fact, right now, the ratio is more like 50-50 rather than one-third, two-thirds. However, it was a goal. It was a measure by which to measure progress of how we're doing in funding higher education. And when we fell short of that goal, it was embarrassing to legislators and other state leaders, and I think appropriately so. That provided an incentive to try harder to get back to the goal. We don't believe that just because we're falling short of a goal that we should repeal the goal. We think we should try harder to make the goal. The current formula for higher education funding recognizes inflation and enrollment as two of the most essential cost drivers that affect the cost of providing higher education. Now, those are going to be repealed as of June 30th, 2007. But we think that any valid measure of what's appropriate funding of higher education needs to take those two factors into account. Let me give you a real good concrete example. The appropriation to MSKU this year is $600 million. Four years ago, in 2002, the appropriation was $601 million. The difference is since 2002 to now, there's been over 10,000 growth in enrollment in MSKU institutions, and inflation over that period of time has been over 11%. And so the $600 million that you give this year isn't anywhere near the value of the $600 million that was provided 4 years ago, because it has been diluted by enrollment and it has been eroded by inflation. And we think any valid higher education formula needs to recognize those factors. If you don't have a formula, essentially, as it's been explained to me by Mr. Berg and others, you would start with your last year's appropriation as your base, and then it'd be a plus and minus from that. And the institutions would come in, or the systems would come in with their wish list, and you would decide what you would want to fund. I guess our difficulty with that system of funding is that there is a great tendency on the part of legislators, and I've been around here a third of a century and I've seen it, to go for the exciting and the glitzy and to ignore the mundane and the necessary. And if you want a good example of that, look at your bonding bill. Everybody wants the new library, everybody wants the new science building, and nobody wants to fix the roofs and the air conditioning systems. They always go wanting. And I'm afraid that if we go to a system like being proposed of just the base plus or minus and so forth, necessary costs like inflation and enrollment are not going to be recognized, and instead we're going to go for the more exciting kinds of projects, and that's going to have devastating results for students. There are real costs when you don't recognize inflation and enrollment. The costs are enormous tuition increases, faculty salaries that don't allow us to hire the kind of quality faculty that we need to be hiring, and larger class sizes. And so we would strongly request that you not repeal the funding formula that we have, at least till something else is in its place. Maybe it needs to be reconsidered. So with that, I thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Plump.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stanton, you're referring now not just to the language on page 2 that's stricken, but you're referring to
last
the language
year.
That was repealed last year.
Yes.
You would like all of it put back, so we...
That's correct, until there's something better in its place.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stanton, thank you for reaffirming my point made earlier.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear from the students, unless there are other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is J.J. Jopi, and I am the Director of University and Government Relations with the Minnesota State University Student Association. First of all, Mr. Stanton was much more eloquent than I could ever be on that same section, but I would like to echo his concerns about the enrollment adjustment and the funding formula for higher education. But I wanted to get back to the section on the co-signers again on page 4. Of the bill, section 8, line 4.32. Ms. Seagard and I have had some discussions about this over the last couple of days, and it looks like after Representative Latz and Representative Eastland and others had some concerns about some of the other provisions, I have some concerns about requiring that a person be a certain age of 24 years of age. There are many students who are under that will have plenty of ability to meet all these other requirements, and I think that you know, students. It may sound a little bit corny, but we're talking about students who were able to do many other things once they turn the age of 18. Once they turn the age of 21, they're able to drink. People are able to be in the armed forces and other things like that. And I think if they meet these other requirements, I don't think it is right for the legislature to determine that the 24 years old should be the rate for that. So that's my concern as you move forward. I'm willing to work with Ms. Yard and maybe some other things that might look a little bit better, but in its current form, that line I would object to.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? Not. I think at this time I'll renew my motion that House File 3924 be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Could you maybe tell me when the date for the putting together of the omnibus bill would occur, maybe?
Maybe. Okay. Not sure what you're going to link to. April 10th is a target date that we're looking at.
Now, Mr. Chair, would that be that the bill's put together and passed? So it would be passed from this committee on April 10th or by April 10th?
That would be our goal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So it gives you a little time.
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, do you have
right
any
before idea? Easter, I think, figuring, right?
So do you have any idea? Now, we referred a few bills to future consideration. What the vehicle is going to be, and when we get to that point, should we have amendments that they're going to be drafted to?
The vehicle is
just the vehicle.
Representative Carlson, yes, this will likely be the vehicle, the one we're dealing with today.
As opposed to a committee bill or...
Yeah. Is that helpful?
Well, it'll be more helpful in a week or two when we begin to draft amendments, I guess, to have an idea what bill it's drafted to, but then I don't... We'll have to get a copy, Mr. Chairman. I assume you'll give one to Representative Pulaski or to each of us that in advance so that we can begin to respond if we choose to have amendments.
Representative Haas?
Mr. Chair, I think my question has been answered. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Anything else? Otherwise, members, we'll see you Monday. Meeting is adjourned.